700 years ago tonight, October 13th, 1307. Tonight marks the 700th anniversary of the fall of the Knights Templar. And it was both the kind of public humiliation and public grab of power that made such an imprint in history that we still talk about it today. The Knights Templar couldn't survive either the public relations campaign that had been built against them, and also the force of the Vatican executing simultaneous orders against the Knights Templar all over Christendom. Even if they were able to save some of their funds and some of their private power, the source of their power, they were stained by these false accusations. The Knights Templar would never be the same. Unable to fight the charge of being satanic, and given a fate which any organization, any religious order, would be unable to overcome, despite a secret not guilty verdict by the Pope. The Knights Templar would be the victims of the biggest land grab and money grab up to that point in our history. The King of France, various kings and princes of Europe working in collusion with the Vatican, took the spoils of the first international banking system as their own. To the Vatican, returned power, which had been lost to this very rigorous organization that had worked semi-autonomously since shortly after its creation. To the Vatican, according to some, went the source of the Knights Templar's power, whatever that might be. And we're still learning more about the Knights Templar in a new book. We're looking forward to booking that author coming up and having them on the air talking about the secret trial of the Knights Templar and what more we can learn about this seminal organization in history through the archives of the Vatican itself. And to us, down to us, as the Knights Templar were relegated to the corridors and secret hallways of history, down to us, of course, comes the Freemasons. Friday the 13th, as a cursed day, and the Da Vinci Code, amongst other things. And all of that, 700 years ago tonight, as human bodies, roped to poles, lit up Europe as human torches. We'll carry on with the conversation of the Knights Templar in the weeks ahead. Be listening for more on that as the book becomes available. Tonight, it's going to be a survival show that you'll never forget. In fact, a survival show we hope you never forget. We also hope you don't need it. But wait till you hear about the information we've got coming up for you next hour, and about the weirdest book you could possibly write next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Andy Roddick, Beat Me with a Frying Pan, the provocative title from Todd Gallagher, sports writer, funny writer. Hey, Todd Gallagher. taking the field with pro athletes and Olympic legends to answer sports fans' burning questions. The book is an attempt to make clear what sports fans have been arguing about for a very long time. Now, I think it's more than just about sports, obviously. I think this is a book which is attempts to explain the preposterous, and we'll explore it coming up in just a second. Also on the way next hour, let me give you a little bit more about Cody London. When all hell breaks loose, stuff you need to survive when disaster strikes. This is also the author of, and I'm just quoting the title, 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive. How to Survive Fear, Panic, and the Biggest Outdoor Killers. Now, 98.6, the book is probably, I don't know, it's geared a little bit more toward, you know, just kind of being out in the wild and, you know, how to be a great sort of companion for hikers, et cetera. There's something, though, that's different about when all hell breaks loose. And especially for the details that he goes into, this rapidly becomes kind of a survival Bible for anybody who's ever been concerned about how they would get through an emergency, and not just like, you know, 5 hours, but I mean, emergency that might go on for a couple of weeks. If you anticipate that we will have a, you might be required to try to shepherd through a difficult time, whether it's without power, without water, without any type of amenities, family members or an organization, or just even yourself, you're going to want to be listening for this coming up when all hell breaks loose. Cody London coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. All right. So Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan. Todd, I just want to start with the premise, first of all, because I love this, that you actually put these ideas to the test. I wonder whether this isn't a whole series of books that you've inadvertently tripped over. What do you think?
I'm sure hoping so. First, I want to thank you so much for having me on. I'm a fan of the show. And I want to say hello to my grandfather, John Chotty, who is in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. He's a longtime listener of the show. So thank you so much. It's very appreciated.
Oh, good. Happy to help. But I think this is what's so interesting about it to us, as we were talking about it earlier in the week, is that you took what some people would just consider to be totally a bizarre idea. Sure, Andy Roddick can beat anybody if he's playing with a tennis racket, but if you gave him the handicap of having to actually play tennis with a frying pan, could the average Joe on the street walk onto a court and beat Andy Roddick with that disability?
Well, and that's interesting that you say that, because something that I really found in doing this book was, it not just that pro athletes are better at these sports than most of us, which we all knew, but to the extent that Andy Roddick could use a frying pan, which I've played tennis my whole life,
right?
I could not, using that same pan, even get the ball over the net.
Right.
And he's playing to the level of a very good high school player with you know, something. There are people who have played much more tennis than I in their lives, who have trained their entire childhood, who Andy Roddick would use a frying pan and would beat them at tennis.
And get some topspin, get backspin, be able to win, go down the line with a winner with a frying pan.
That's absolutely right, yes.
Okay, and you did this. I mean, this is the interesting part is, these aren't just, you're not just sort of theoretically musing about the question of why not block a goal? Why not in hockey? Why don't they have a super obese person as the goalie and just take up the entire net? And they would be guaranteed of it. You actually put it to the test by developing a super obese suit.
That's right. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
When I wrote for ESPN, I would hear these questions from sports fans all the time. And it's sort of an epidemic in sports. And I think also it's sort of in our culture in general, where people, they argue things, but they're not willing to take the next step to actually find out the answer. And that was something that was very appealing to me. So in the case of this fat suit, that's something that, you know, writers at ESPN have written and asked, why doesn't a team try this? Would it work? They talked about it on the West Wing. It's actually been a kind of popular, crazy sports question. So what I did was I got George Romero's special effects school, and George Romero did Night of the Living Dead, and
right,
they built a fat suit that replicated the fattest man in the history of the world, a Robert Earl Hughes, I believe, who was roughly 1,200 pounds. And I had the Washington Capitals, who are an NHL team. They played against a goalie that I put in the fat suit. And the guy in the fat suit did pretty well. He shut down the Capitals' first 15 shots. But what we learned is that even a man that size still doesn't take up the entire net. And unless you take up the whole net, there are still going to be openings that in certain scenarios, like a breakaway, an NHL player will score on every time.
Okay, but I read the chapter on this, and I still want to get to a larger point here in just a second. But let's just go there. No, let's just go there for the moment. Is that I read that section particularly about how, you know, an NHL player on a breakaway could still score on a super obese person blocking up the entire net because they don't have the speed to be able to compensate for somebody on a breakaway. But I think if you put somebody that big in the net, it would just change the way in which you play defense. And you would you'd have to play for the breakaway, and you'd have to play against that because that would be your one weakness. And it would force the other team to always have to play for breakaways, and that would change their offense. And that would force them to play your game, and you would win.
That's a brilliant point. I wish I had a co-writer on this book.
Well, I just seemed like, as I was reading that, I'm thinking, okay, well, then anyway. So
the problem is that you actually make a very valid point. I will say, though, that there are still situations that, you know, that you just can't consistently defend against that would arise. Also, you have the issue, the larger issue, is the fact that the man would die on the ice.
Well, that's true. That somebody that big, that being a goalie is a lot harder than just sitting there blocking the net. And you'd have,
there's very strict restrictions on the size of goalie padding. Goalie, for a uniform, you can get an exemption that you could fit the man in, but the padding is non-negotiable. So large parts of his body would be exposed to getting hit by hockey pucks.
Right, and that would be a lot to ask of anybody. But you might find a lot of people willing to take that for the money, even for just one season.
No. Right, now,
and then we'll get to some of the other things you explored here in just a second. But I think it was that question about, you know, why not put the obese guy in the goal that got me thinking, and this is why I want to go to the phones coming up at the bottom of the hour, of other things in history or other things which, you know, not Mythbusters, not talking about, like, you know, putting, you know, Alka-Seltzer in Coke bottles and stuff like that. But, I mean, I just wonder whether there are other things that people have wondered about. Why don't, if you did X or Y, wouldn't it mean, like, for example, the classic question of if you took, you know, enough money and you bought every lottery ticket, wouldn't you be guaranteed of a lottery win? I mean, I think it's sort of the same type of thing where you just go, oh, what? I wonder how, you know, and I know that mathematically that may not be any more true than winning the Stanley Cup with an obese goalie, but I think there's a lot of other questions like that, and I want to see if I can find some of those for you at the bottom of the hour.
That sounds great. I do not have a great imagination, so if we're going to do another one, we're going to need some help.
Yeah, well, I think it'll probably end up being a non-sports book.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to explore the same what-if theme. And I think there are other what-if guy-at-the-end-of-the-bar questions, which just no one has ever done what you did, which is actually put them to the test.
And we actually are thinking about doing it for movies as well, where we're taking some of – now, this is a little bit different, but taking some of these movie premises, which are in many cases flawed, and testing them out, or in some cases not flawed. A good example would be, you know, the great film Trading Places. If you took a homeless man and gave him some training and made him a CEO, now obviously this wouldn't apply to every homeless man, but I guarantee you there are quite a few that with a couple weeks of training and the right outfit, you could introduce as an executive and they could pass.
I wonder then too is if you could do a whole series of these questions based on Eddie Murphy movies, like Coming to America. What if you took a king or a prince from an African nation and brought him to New York?
As long as we don't have to do Pluto Nash.
Oh, God. Well, is there a premise in Pluto Nash? Is there anything?
I don't know.
All right. So at the bottom of the hour, I'm just curious, other what-if questions of history. Help out Todd Gallagher, whose grandfather's been a longtime Coast to Coast listener. All right. So then This was another one too. One of the great questions of what would happen if you had an entire team of short people with, you know, little 8-inch high strike zones? Wouldn't they be guaranteed of winning every game, and they'd never have to swing at a pitch?
And that is absolutely a fact. Is if Major League Baseball allowed a team to do this, and a team would go along with it, and actually I had found a general manager that wanted to put midgets in a game, and he had said, I would love to do this, but Major League Baseball won't let me. But the fact of the matter is because of their size, no matter how talented a pitcher, they are not going to be able to strike the little guys out. And we tested this out with a former Major League pitcher, and he really struggled.
With a whole lineup of just short people.
Yeah.
Just little people.
It would just roll over. They would continually walk. There would never be an out. The New York Yankees would not defeat this team.
Could not defeat because you just couldn't.
No, go ahead.
No. I was just emphasizing because you could not get it. You couldn't get a strike on any of them. You couldn't throw enough pitches to get three strikes on a batter like that.
That's right. Okay. And especially if you really wanted to amp it up and get the guys that were in the foot and a half tall range. It's virtually, especially the angle at which the pitcher is throwing at, it's so steep that it's virtually impossible. Something with that one that I kind of hope to see happen is I spoke with a number of attorneys in doing the chapter, including the attorney who represented Casey Martin, the golfer who sued for the right to use a golf cart in a PGA Tour event because he had a foot problem. He
right.
said under the Americans with Disabilities Act that if a midget wanted to sue, he would have a very good case and would probably win, and Major League Baseball in some way would be forced to accommodate him. I think that would be fascinating to see.
Now, is there a minimum height requirement in Major League Baseball?
No, and that's actually the point that the attorney made and Bill Veeck years ago made, which
right.
is who is to say what a fair height is? Is Phil Rizzuto was 5'4", he was the American League MVP. Is he too short? Does he gain an unfair advantage? Who's going to draw that line?
Right, and I'm actually surprised, as cheap as they are, that the Tribune Company hasn't tried this with the Chicago Cubs.
Well, it would be a very cost-effective strategy as well.
Exactly.
Publicity.
Yeah, all you got to do is just hire, you know, you could hire 24 guys and rotate them. You could pay them. You don't have to be paying major league salaries to field a team like that.
You could pay them the minimum.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, though, and I thought this came up too with the NHL discussion about the super obese goalie, is that you have there's sort of this unwritten rule of sportsmanship, which teams wouldn't do it because of the way in which they would their reputations would suffer, or that the sport itself would come under too much scrutiny for not being worthwhile in the first place. That if you took it too far, people would start to go look up and say, wait a second, what the heck is this? This is just like a sideshow carnival thing.
What's funny to me about that is two things. Is number one, which is I've worked in sports most of my adult life, and these people who are talking about honor and sportsmanship are typically not the most honorable or sporting people themselves. And the second part of it, which is we're talking about made-up games that for children, you know,
right.
the notion that sports are so serious that we couldn't try something like this and would bring shame and dishonor to an entire city, to me is ludicrous.
Well, except that there's so much money involved
yeah.
that it's almost like a conspiracy of silence. Nobody bring this up for fear that somebody might actually try it. All right. So when we go through the book, I just want to real quickly again. All of these scenarios are sports scenarios in Todd Gallagher's book, Andy Roddick Beat Me with a Frying Pan. And I think it was really cool how you talked a lot of celebrities into doing. This or working with you, you couldn't get Mike Tyson to do it though, right?
Actually, yes and no. Mike did agree to go along with this, which was to fight 10 men in one evening. The idea was we were going to take the 10 toughest men in America, meaning we were going to do a real manhunt and find, you know, a guy who was not a professional fighter, but you know, was a 6'5", 300-pound bouncer in Detroit who had knocked out everyone he's ever come across, just some big bully. And Tyson was going to fight them one round after the other. For each person he knocked out, he would get somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $500,000. If they knocked out Tyson, they would be sharing the purse, which would be $2 or $3 million. And Tyson had agreed to do this. Unfortunately, he ran into some
legal problems,
all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, is he doing 10 a night at that brothel where he's working, or is that did that work out for him? All right, so coming up, you don't have to answer that.
Confirm or deny that.
All right, so we're gonna do we're gonna roll out the questions here for you just a second. Help a Coast to Coastie out here with Andy Roddick, beat me with a frying pan. Todd Gallagher. We'll run a bunch of other questions, other things he explored, like does a six-fingered pitcher have an unfair advantage? And playing one-handed, could a pro billiards player beat an amateur? But we want to get your questions of history, of culture. What would you have him explore next on Coast to Coast? As we speak, Todd Gallagher, author of the book Andy Roddick Beat Me with a Frying Pan, it looks like the Boston Red Sox are about to lose to Cleveland in the 11th, barring a bench filled with little people that could come out and get walked and score some easy runs. It looks like Boston's losing this one. But although sports questions were explored in this book, which was a great idea, putting all of these sports bar argument starters to the test, giving Andy Roddick a frying pan and taking him on at tennis, seeing whether or not he could beat Todd Gallagher or not. I want to see whether in the questions on anybody else out there at any of the phone numbers has something they wanted always to see somebody like you put to the test. And I like that idea where you're talking about the Eddie Murphy question, you know, about taking somebody who is homeless off the street and giving them every advantage. Could they make it as a CEO? I think there are other great what ifs out there, and this audience is just sort of twisted and creative enough to come up with perhaps your next book. So hang on for a second. We'll see whether or not we get any good ones out there. I love this thing about the six-fingered pitcher, whether or not a six-fingered pitcher would have an advantage. Did you find one?
There is one who pitches for the Philadelphia Phillies by the name of Antonio Alfonseca. And Alfonseca is not the best of pitchers, but people had always wondered if he gained an unfair advantage. And what I learned is that while really only three fingers, four, the fourth sort of being for support, the ring finger being for support, are really used to throw the ball, a pitcher with less than five fingers can gain an advantage, because if he has a deformed finger or if he has a stub, it can impart an unusual spin on the ball. In fact, Three-Finger Brown was a amazing pitcher long ago for the, I believe, the Cleveland Browns.
Cleveland Indians pitching tonight, whether a billiards player playing with just one arm could beat an amateur.
And let me clarify: this is not a one-armed billiards player. This is a man with an arm behind his back.
With one arm tied behind his back.
I've played a great deal of pool in my life, and I like to think I'm a very good player. And I went and played a man by the name of Ismael Paez, who is a great champion. And he played with one hand and beat up on me pretty badly.
How much money did he take from you?
thankfully none. But what he did tell me is that one-handed games of pool used to be very big. And you know, anyone who's played pool, this man playing one-handed, mind you, can break and then run out, then shoot and make every ball on the table
with one arm, without missing. Okay,
so all right. If you do better than that, then you might be able to beat him.
All right, and that's where I'll pick it up coming up next. Todd Gallagher, Andy Roddick, Beat Me with a Frying Pan next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, Todd Gallagher, we'll put this idea to the test itself on the phones here in just a second. Andy Roddick, Beat Me with a Frying Pan. The book's been out for what, just a couple of weeks, hasn't it?
About a week now.
Okay, and what about a TV show? Did you do videos of any of these?
It's all been videotaped. You can actually see some of the video on my website and by the book, which is todd33.com, T-O-D-D-33.com. We're going to be releasing more of that, but right now we are talking about doing it as a TV show, and it's looking good on that front. So hopefully you'll be seeing that in the future.
And what will you do for an encore? Let's go to the calls. First-time caller line, Dan is in St. Louis on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Dan.
How you doing? First-time caller, long-time listener.
Glad to have you. You're buying into the concept here, so what might be an interesting question to explore?
Well, the pool playing question.
Yeah.
I play pool every day, I'm not a pro by all means, but I consider myself very good. And one of the persons who taught me how to play pool actually beat me one-handed before. However, he didn't put his arm behind his back. He put his left hand, which would be his bridge hand, on the table and held the pool cue about 2 inches above his hand to, kind of pretend like he was using his bridge. And he beat me. He didn't break with the one hand, but he shot everything else in one-handed.
Just holding the cue over his other hand without ever actually using it.
Right. He didn't use his bridge hand. He just used it to, like, kind of, you know, guide him.
It's, yeah, it's for balance, too, I believe, to kind of keep the same proportions.
Correct.
Very good.
It's sad to admit it, but he beat me.
Yep. Thank you. Wildcard line. Ed is in Fort Worth on Coast to Coast AM. Ed?
Hey, Ian. Listen to the show all the time, guy. Hey,
glad to have
you. If you was to have two different teams, like for instance, I live here in Fort Worth, Dallas Cowboys from like the 70s and the Dallas Cowboys from the 1990s, how would their different equipment and would affect their speed and hitting, and would they be able to sustain the same kind of impact that other, you know, from the 70s as far as going into the 90s?
Well, my opinion on this, I have a very strong opinion on this question, which is not shared by everyone, I should say. However, I look at it through the prism of Olympic records. And if you took, let's say you took Mark Spitz, his gold-winning Olympic swimming times from the 70s, they are now being blown away by 13-year-old girls. So what we're seeing is not only are people getting so much bigger, faster, and stronger even over that short period of time, but they're refining technique as well. And we're seeing that in all sports. And I would have to believe that that would hold true in the NFL. And I believe that it wouldn't even be close. I think there's so much advancement even. And, you know, I had many players who I interviewed actually about this topic in baseball who say, Jeremy Reed, who plays for the Mariners, said there's so much advancement even year to year. And that if you were to go 10, 20 years in the past, that it would be a total mismatch. And again, if you look at the Olympic raw times in terms of raw speed, and if you look at the average size of the players from that era versus this era, it's to me, no question.
All right. But I got to tell you up front, I'm disappointed so far. I'm really looking for that next round of questions, and I'm not expecting them to be sports questions.
I have one for you.
Okay, go ahead. Give me another.
Rip from the headlines of your blog, which is, if you made a wedding dress out of toilet paper, could it be passed off as a real wedding dress?
Yes, I think the answer is clearly yes. if you saw those photos,
they're
cool
amazing.
Cool pumpkin photos too on the blog too, aren't those amazing?
Oh, those were incredible.
All right, but I really mean it. I mean, I think that there are. I just can't think of what they are, but I think there are times when I've been sitting around with 15 other people, and I'm not talking about the sort of pseudoscience experiments of Mythbusters, which, while very cool, I just think that's different. There's these larger things of what would happen if. And
what
so
if we took a team of supermodels and we put them as a sales force for a Honda dealership
and see whether or not they could do it.
That's
just
right.
Based on sex appeal.
Yes. Purely on that. Having, you know, let's assuming the ones we select have no real ability as salespeople, but purely based on sex appeal, would they be able to take over the car industry in that town?
I think that's a really interesting question. That might make a great TV episode if you launch it. Let's go east of the Rockies. Bob has a thought on this on Coast to Coast AM. Bob?
Yes, sir.
What would be your challenge for Todd Gallagher?
In the early times before World War II, Patton at the national matches at Camp Perry in Ohio near Toledo, fired two pistols simultaneously in rapid fire at separate targets and qualified. And later in life, in the Olympics, he where they go cross country on skis carrying a rifle and fired a target.
The biathlon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. And he fired such a tight group that they claimed he completely missed the target with one round. They could only account for like 9 out of 10 rounds. Recently, they've reinspected that and claim they can prove that he did really get all 10 rounds in the target. But here's two extremes of marksmanship.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea, too. Yeah, marksmanship, I guess, that didn't come up in your book, did it?
No, but one that I had thought about was if you took either a professional hunter or a professional marksman, there were two applications that I was very interested in that we didn't have time to do, which was one, what if you took him to the amusement park and put him on some of those, you know, water gun games?
Right.
Would he win a prize every time? In fact,
right.
with a team of athletes, could you clean out
an amusement park? Right.
And then the other one was less interesting, I would say, which is the video game Big Buck Hunter. How would a professional hunter do on that?
They'd have to do better than my kids on that. All the time. All right, as I was thinking, and I want to get to a couple more of these that are actually in the book. What was the one you were surprised about the most? Were the outcome you actually thought, oh, this is a done deal. There's no way that pro athlete X was going to be able to, you know, win under the circumstances that you presented.
The one that really, really surprised me was in the realm of wiffle ball, which I played wiffle ball growing up all the time. I still play wiffle ball with my friends, and we always wondered how would a pro baseball player do if he was in our wiffle ball game. And we concluded, of course, he would kill us. So what we did was we ramped it up a little, and I got the best wiffle ball players in the country, and they were in Phoenix, Arizona. And I had them, and I had not just a baseball player, but the National League batting champion, Freddie Sanchez for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I had him face the wiffle ball pitchers. And in 19 at-bats, he struck out 18 times. That shocked me because I thought the exact opposite would happen. I thought he would do so well that they would not even be able to get him out, let alone dominate him the way they did. But, you know, as it turns out, these guys were throwing remarkably hard. They're throwing 90 miles per hour from about 40 feet away. And the ball is dipping 3 feet, and it's going, you know, it's starting over Freddie's head, and it's ending up on the ground. It was mind blowing to me.
Right. You know, actually, when the previous caller brought up the classic question of a team from the 70s versus a team from the 90s, which, you know, we can never do except mathematically.
Unless someone builds a time machine.
Right. I guess I was thinking, too, and I don't know whether this ever comes up, but whether or not you take one athlete from one discipline and you try them out in another discipline, and how long does it take them to, I mean, since they talk about, you know, athletes are just, you know, naturally gifted, mm-hmm. how long would it take? Because we know Michael Jordan, as great as he was as a basketball player, really couldn't make it as a baseball player.
A good rule of thumb with that is the higher the level of skill that is required, the harder the transition is. But what you do see is that in sports that are more based on how big, strong, and fast you are, you can transition reasonably quick if you're a fantastic athlete. One that we did was I took a group of sumo wrestlers and got them a tryout in the Arena Football League. And they were outstanding. They were very, very good. Everyone came away impressed. And I sent the tape to the defensive line coach for the Minnesota Vikings, and he said that he thought they could be better than half of the linemen in the NFL if they were willing to apply themselves.
And yet, there's probably more money, and they don't have to work as hard in Japan for it.
It's actually more grueling to be a sumo wrestler in terms of lifestyle. But what happens is it's just hard. It's hard to convince them that it's as appealing because there's not the level of glamour to them in playing in the NFL.
All right. Well, I'll see whether or not between now and the end of the hour whether we get any more good questions of history to put to the test. But Andy Roddick, Beat Me with a Frying Pan, is the book from Todd Gallagher. We're just talking about the what ifs of sports and some of the other things that they did in this book on a chapter by chapter basis. I think the one that sort of surprised me was this idea about raising the basketball hoop up to 12 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And this was what, to compensate for all of the height of the current teams, and that today's guards are taller than yesterday's centers, kind of an idea.
Yeah. And not only are they taller, but they can athletically do things that no one's ever seen. They've just advanced to such a degree that let's make the game a little more difficult and maybe it'll bring some skill back into it. And they actually tried this because people had those concerns that players were getting too big, too strong, too fast in the 50s. And this is when George Mikan was dominating. They wanted to raise the hoop. And what they found is that while it does bring sort of a little bit more teamwork into the game, because there are so many misses on the high hoop, the big players, the centers, just dominate even more, and it makes for just a very ugly game.
All right. We have Don east of the Rockies in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Todd Gallagher. Andy Roddick beat me with a frying pan. Hey, Don?
Yeah, one I always wanted ever since I was a kid. What would happen if the best college football team played the worst NFL team? Thank you.
Okay.
That is a great question. I wrote an entire chapter on that question, including doing extensive interviews with tons of NFL players, tons of college players, because a lot of people were talking about the USC has been so good the last couple years. Many people were wondering, could they defeat the Oakland Raiders, let's say? And what I found is that all of the pro players are just so good. You know, even the worst players on the pro teams are so good that it would really be very difficult. What you might find, though, is a college team could beat a team like the Raiders because their best players may be better than the best players the Raiders have. So they might, if on the right day, be able to win a game. But overall, the size and the age and the experience that the pros possess would make for a victory for the NFL guys.
West of the Rockies, Phil is in California for Todd Gallagher on Coast to Coast AM. Phil?
Yeah, hi. I have a non-sports question for Todd.
Go for it.
All right. I would like him to research and find out if he could see conclusively if a man named Gustav Whitehead flew a heavier-than-aircraft before the Wright brothers. There was a book on this years ago that I remember from school. And Cliff Robertson, for a while, was working on trying to recreate the craft as it was pictured because they had photographs of it. It looked basically like a big canvas-covered bathtub kind of thing with these big flapping wings on it. And he's supposed to have flown before the Wright brothers did, and there's supposed to be documentation.
How could it have gotten off the ground? What did he use for propulsion?
Oh, he had an internal combustion engine.
Okay.
Yeah,
he had internal, in the bathtub.
Flapping wings. I meant big wings that looked like they would flap like the ornithopters, but it wasn't an ornithopter.
Huh. Very interesting. I guess that's part of what I'm getting at too. Is I wonder whether even a modern application of those questions comes up, Todd, where you know the equivalent of the of sports guys sitting around, you know, talking about these what if questions. I wonder whether the same things go on around around the bars where pilots hang out.
Oh, and I'm sure they do.
What are the other great sort of what if places where people are getting together and go, what if you did this or what if you did that?
Well, I think any profession that or any interest that anyone has, they have these questions. Mine just happened to be sports, but you know, as we've been seeing, it is fairly pervasive. And if anyone would like to email me, also, you know, I will get to work on some of these.
Yeah, I don't know whether you could solve every question of history or whether that would even come up, but I just think some of these things, if you could put it to the test. And to see whether or not something would actually work, I think there's a market for that. I think you may never have to write for TV again.
that would make me so happy if I never had to do that again. One that sort of has some good crossover appeal that we did in the book, which was somebody wanted to know is how far away are we from having a computer controlled race car?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
A NASCAR race.
And
I would have guessed. A friend of mine who this actually kind of came out of JPL, was a friend whose girlfriend works for JPL, kind of came up with this idea. And I assumed that we were 30, 40 years away from this. And after speaking to David Stavins of the Stanford racing team, who they do these kinds of races, he said, right now they have a race car that could win a NASCAR time trial. And we're probably only 5 years away from having one that could win an actual NASCAR race.
Wow. Well, I'll give you my great what if from the two teams that were, you know, of course, the dominating teams of my youth. Is it still possible in my dreams? Is it still possible ever that the Dallas Cowboys could play the Oakland Raiders and they would both lose? That's all I could hope for. All right. Well, thank you so much, and say hi to your grandfather again. Go ahead.
Thank you. This has been a true honor.
Andy Roddick, Beat Me with a Frying Pan, Todd Gallagher, very creative book. Thanks for having fun with us on Coast to Coast AM. And let's explore it then. Coming up next, Cody London, When All Hell Breaks Loose, How to Survive When Disaster Strikes. It is the ultimate survival guide next on Coast to Coast AM.